Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sanfats from Australia. Coming up in the show, we're going to have a look at the questions from the readers, and we're also going to have a chat with Duncan Steer. Well, I've had a pretty quiet week so far, but David, you've had your first loss. Any tears?
Unfortunately, we did lose. It was a very, very good batting track and a beautiful sunny day. We turned up at the opposition's ground. I was selected in the first 11 because the normal first 11 wicketkeeper was away for the week, so I got my chance. And we won the toss, decided to bat, and the opposition captain, we overheard him saying that he'd be happy with any score less than 250, and that's in 50 overs. And we did not get 250. We got 221 for 7. Our opening batsman got 100, but unfortunately, it was really the middle overs. We started well the first 10, 15 overs. We were going along at about 4.5 an over, which is, you know, pretty good, especially early on, because you expect to bat a little bit more slowly early on and then speed it up as you go through the innings. But we started well and then slowed down really badly in the middle and then had a lot of catching up to do at the end and ended up with 221. We didn't think that was going to be enough, and that is, although obviously we were going to try our hardest, and 221 is still a defendable score. You know, you can, if you get early wickets, you can still defend that. But unfortunately, we didn't. Their opening partnership was about 150, something like that. And one of their openers in particular batted very, very well. He just hit it to all parts, including a six, which was a very good shot. I mean, it was a short boundary, but it was a straight six over mid-on. From obviously my position, keeping wicket, I saw it perfectly. And it just flew away. Hit the top of a house. There's a house sort of facing the pitch, with a slope roof. Yeah. And hit the very top of this slope roof on the house, and just bounced off and disappeared behind the house. It was a big hit. I mean, it wasn't a giant hit, but the fact that he almost cleared the house with it, even on a short boundary, meant it was a pretty big hit. And it's pretty good to do that over mid on. A straight hit over mid on is always hard, isn't it? So we only managed to take two wickets. And I think probably the way they were batting, we probably would have needed at least another 100 overs to get them out. So they knocked off our score in about 47 overs, 46, 47, something like that.
How did you go personally, David?
Yeah, all right. I didn't get the chance to bat because I always bat down the order, very far down the order.
And how's your keeping form?
Yeah, pretty solid. Didn't have much to do, as you can imagine, when it's such a good batting track. Nothing very much was coming through to me, either being the bat or being left, because anything with a bit of width was being smashed away. So the only time really that I got to catch the ball was a couple of leaves early on, a couple of balls that went down the leg side, which were quite wide, and that was about it. No chances came to me, which is quite amazing. We've had four potential games so far this season. We've played three of them. One's been abandoned due to the weather. And I haven't had a catch or a stumping yet. And I haven't missed a catch or a stumping yet. I just have not had one chance this season. It's amazing. In three games, I haven't had one chance come to me.
You've got to make sure you're ready when it comes.
Well, exactly. Apart from that one, which I talked about last week, where the chat edged it to me and didn't walk. But obviously then that was given not out, so we can't count that. Yeah. But other than that, nothing. Absolutely nothing. But I was happy. I was happy with my performance. So what have you been up to? You been in the nets?
Yeah, well, most recently, me and my mates, we've had a little thing going where we're trying to rein in our thoughts and try to adapt to different situations. So the situation we've been practicing on is blocking or being defensive when the situation needs.
Oh, yeah.
Because often the teams we play under, there's a massive collapse. And when the lower order tells us to stand up and sort of hang in there for the next 30 overs or so, we can't do that because we're not used to it. So try to sort of block out different balls or leave the bad ones. Leave the good ones, sort of thing. And we found it was really a mind game. It's not more skill. It's just 90% mind, I reckon. Because when we were bowling to each other as well, we sort of taunt the batsman. And the batsman being only human, they try to do stupid things as well. So it's really about controlling your mind. Have you ever been in situations like that, David? And what have you done?
Yeah, very often, yeah. I often find myself in a situation like that. Because of the games we play, you can have a draw.
Yeah.
And I tend to back down the order, certainly in the first team anyway, I tend to back down the order. I find myself at number 11 sometimes. Well, in the first 11, I can pretty much guarantee I'll be at number 11. So in that situation, you might have to go in with, five, six overs left to bat out the last few overs to prevent the opposition from winning. Well, you've got no chance of winning yourself, but you'll have to prevent them from winning. So, yeah, but fortunately, my natural tendency is to play that way anyway. So I don't really have a problem with being able to block out. I've always been quite good at blocking out. In fact, probably my problem is I'm a bit too defensive sometimes, and when I'm batting up the order, I don't quite play as attackingly as I could. But that's another issue, really. Yeah, but a lot of people in a similar situation to you, they do play a rash shot sometimes. You see that a lot. You see that, even at test level, even the best players in the world can lose their concentration and get themselves out. So, yeah, it's definitely a mind game. A good game I know for improving that side of it is you keep a score. You have a score, and you instead of having runs for hitting the ball, you have a scoring system which biases defending and leaving the ball. So, for example, if you leave it, you get 2 runs. If you defend it straight, then either front foot or back foot, then you get 1 run. And you see how many runs you get. And maybe if you can also add in like maybe what an attacking shot, like if you play a drive in the V, only in the V, so you can't claim that you've driven one when you've smashed it over mid wicket. You have to play a drive in the V. If you play a drive in the V, you get 4 or something like that. You can make up your own rules, but the key is you reward the defensive play and see who gets the most runs before they get out. That's quite a good way of turning it into a bit of a game.
Especially, it's all right to practice in the nets and everything, but I really think match practice is where player skills really comes under the pump. So I was talking to the other guys today, and they were saying that if we were exposed to more situations in match conditions, then we'd get better at these kind of things. But yeah, definitely these kind of training methods help as well.
Do you have access to a square that you could play on, an artificial pitch that you could play on that isn't a net?
The problem with in Australia is once winter comes in, they cover up squares with grass and all that for
Oh, okay.
soccer and rugby and all the other sports. So it's really hard to find a square to play on other than the nets. So
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
that's one of the bad things. But maybe when summer comes around, that can be practiced.
You can have a practice game or something, or there's ways and means of doing it. Yeah, I mean, I can understand that you can't get to play on a square. That's fair enough. But that could be quite frustrating. I mean, over here you can't. Once the winter comes, you can't play at all on grass because it's just too muddy. There's just conditions are just too cold and too wet, and you just wouldn't be able to, even if the square, even if there was an artificial pitch there, you wouldn't be able to play on it. So, unless you're talking about the depths of winter when when the ground becomes frozen, then you're all right. You can play in a pair of trainers then, I suppose. But other than that, you can't do anything at all. So, but yeah, I mean, that turning up the pressure by keeping score is a good way of compromising. So maybe try that in your next nets.
Yeah, we'll try that definitely. For our 5 question section, we've got an interview with Duncan Sear, the editor of Spin Magazine, which is an English cricket magazine, and we're about to hear what he has to say.
Duncan Steer is the editor of Spin, a monthly magazine here in the UK with a comprehensive website and podcast covering content for real cricket fans. Duncan, how did you get into cricket yourself?
My dad was very big on cricket. He was actually captain of London schoolboys in the 1950s. So I was taken along to cricket from a very, very early age, and that was at the Oval watching Surrey. And then that was it. That was it, and it continues. You know, it's a big thing between me and my dad, and I've been watching cricket now for like 30 years, I suppose. So it's just there. It's just kind of ingrained in me.
And how did the magazine come about?
The magazine was my idea. I've been a journalist all my working life, and I was invited to edit the Test Match magazines when Channel 4 took over the television coverage. So Channel 4 had this input, and they wanted to sell magazines at the Test Matches that reflected the kind of nature of their coverage, which was kind of newer and snappier. And I suppose more modern than the BBC's had been. So I was invited to edit those. And after 3 years of doing that, I thought, well, maybe we could do something that did the same job but was available all around the country. So I pitched Spin to a publisher, and they took it on. And here we are.
So if the magazine's philosophy is a bit snappier and a bit more modern, what sort of people read Spin magazine?
I think people who really want to know about cricket, I mean, my guiding philosophy really is, what do I want to know as a fan? What questions will I ask the players? I think there's a lot of sports journalism that's really quite bland and quite dull, and you can listen to a lot of Five Live, say, and the interviews, you could write the interviews yourself before you even hear them, very, very standard stuff. So so that remit kind of covers everything. You know, I want to know what Stuart Broad's been working on in the nets. I want to know who's been helping him. I want to know if, you know, he can tell me anything that could help improve my game. But I also want to know what's the most he's ever spent on a shirt. You know, it's kind of, I think the conversational thing's quite important. So in terms of readers, I think that's all cricket fans. I think we might have a sort of reputation as being more popular with younger supporters and younger players. But I think anyone who really cares about cricket, and they could have only just got into it, or they could have been following it for like 40 years, but I think they'll find something in our magazine. It's quite hard to judge who your audience is, of course, because the people who are very active, so if you go on Facebook and, you know, people who email you, probably do tend to be younger. But we may have a silent majority of professors and colonels, I don't know.
How do you find doing your own podcast?
Well, I love doing the podcast, which hopefully comes across. I think that there's probably a slight divide, because I sort of perceive that while we do some quite serious things in the magazine, and we sort of have coaching stuff and quite serious interviews, but there's a kind of fun, I think, at the heart of what we do, because as I say, we are fans, and at the end of the day, it is meant to be entertainment. I mean, even if you're kind of analysing someone's technique, it's kind of, ultimately, it's meant to be for enjoyment, isn't it? I think more of that probably comes over on the podcast, because we want to, in kind of the tradition of Test Match Special, we want to kind of make it sound like friends talking about cricket. So we might, you know, drift off. I mean, we often record them in the Wetherspoons in Streatham. I don't know if you know it, but it's you can imagine. So sometimes the conversation will drift off onto other subjects and so on. But I think that's just natural. I think it's like if you go to a cricket match with your friends, you don't spend the whole day talking about cricket. So I think it's that kind of very sort of discursive sort of worldview that I think cricket fans have, and it's the nature of the game, isn't it, that you know you don't just sit there talking about cover drives. So I love it. I think podcasts, as you'll know, David, they're probably the coming thing with iPhones and stuff. I mean, they haven't quite hit their full audience yet, but we do okay. We're sort of number two or number three of cricket podcasts on iTunes, I think. So and the other cricket podcasts apart from yours aren't very good, are they? Can I say that? Can I continue? I think there's a certain sort of I think we do a podcast because we love it, and we love chatting, and we want to kind of entertain people, and we think we kind of you know, it's just very natural. Whereas a lot of podcasts, I mean, I don't think Tony Gregg's cut out for podcasting. I think there's a lot of the Cricket Info ones are probably, it ill behoves me to say this, obviously, people were writing, but they're sort of doing them because they have to rather than because they want to. And, you know, I think we're doing it because we want to.
speaking of the future and modern things like that, you've recently jazzed up the website at spincricket.com. How's that going?
Yeah, it's going well. I mean, we are a magazine, a print magazine, basically, and we sell in the UK, and that's our business. You know, and one of our big struggles is I think that people think that magazines are kind of like an out-of-date newspaper, whereas we think they're like a very up-to-date book. So, you know, so sort of, you know, a week after 2020 World Cup, that's the ITC World 2020, of course, you can get a souvenir of it on the newsstand with all the pictures and analysis and stuff. So that's our mission, is to try and, get more people into reading magazines, and our magazine specifically. So the website is kind of there to promote the magazine, but we're getting some interesting content on there. And I mean, the thing that's always been slightly frustrating is that we often get stories ahead of other people, but without a website, we often get trumped. I mean, we were the first people to break the story of the Indian Cricket League, which has sort of kind of changed the face of cricket in that, you know, the IPL was set up in, you know, response to it and so on. But we got that story first, and it was still an exclusive when we had it in the magazine. But I think, recently we've had Atul Sharma, you know, the young Indian bowler who's never played a game, got signed for Rajasthan Royals. And the Mongoose Bat as well. We were the first people to write about the Mongoose Bat. So having a website enables us to draw attention to ourselves because we can get these stories before other people and hopefully increase our reputation as, you know, good cricket writers and people who know what's going on. And I think, I mean, obviously you're doing this all day, every day as well, but you just end up meeting and speaking to so many cricket people that after a while you do know quite a lot and you do hear quite a lot. So in a way it's just trying to find the medium through which to communicate that to the world.
Duncan Steer, those are your five questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Duncan, for your time. I think it's time we get on to the questions, David.
We certainly can. And you may remember from last week that Ian Pont from maverickcricket.com will be joining us every week on the line to answer a bowling question for us. So before I start answering some questions, I have Ian on the line now. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Thanks, David.
This week's question is from a listener who contacted me via Twitter. One thing you hear players talking about is finding their rhythm. What is rhythm, and can you achieve it on demand?
Wow, what is rhythm? It's a very difficult thing to pinpoint. I guess rhythm, in another phrase, would be timing, or how the body kind of snaps through the bowling action. I think as fast bowlers listening to this, if we've all bowled quickly at some stage, we'll know there'll be days when we go out and just everything sort of clicks. You know, you're downhill with the wind, it feels great, the sun on your back, your ball flies through. The keeper goes back a few more meters and everybody comes up to you and says, wow, you're bowling with gas today. It's really coming through. And there'll be other days when it doesn't matter what you do, it feels like you're towing a caravan. You know, you just don't feel right. The ground isn't right. Your boots aren't right. The wind's in the wrong direction. And all of those things upset your rhythm or your timing. So that would suggest to me rhythm isn't something that you can just switch on with a big switch. I think when a lot of people wake up in the morning, sometimes they feel like they're going to be really good, and other days they're going to feel like a bag of potatoes. You know, they're not going to feel right about it. But for me, if you have a pretty good technical action, rhythm should come naturally off the back of that. And this is sometimes where we get a bit confused about people having quite a robotic or mechanical action. I understand why sometimes that doesn't look overly pretty. And we see somebody with, in inverted commas, a natural action, and we say, well, that looks very rhythmical. But rhythm's a very personal thing, and it's not about necessarily the style of your action. Rhythm comes from your sequencing of muscles, stretch and contraction, and that's something that most bowlers will never understand, and that's an obvious thing to say. So rhythm tends to come from, it's quite a kinesthetic thing, it's emotive, it's a feeling. And there are no specific ways, I don't think, of saying today is going to be great, tomorrow's going to be horrible. It's just what it is at the time you're bowling. It's nothing to do with action necessarily, but it is all to do with feeling and rhythm.
Ian will be back next week with another answer, and you can find out more about Ian's coaching at maverickscricket.com. OK, Kevin, over to you with the rest of the questions.
Welcome to the question section of the My Cricket Coach show. Our first question is from Chris, and he thanks you, David, for all the training and nutrition help regarding to cricket. And he asks, regarding the back foot drive, how do we play short of a length balls or balls just short of a length? Is it generally best to go forward or backwards to these? My other question is, can you offer any advice or drills on improving hip mobility, as this is important not just for cricket? I haven't heard of any, I don't think we've had a question on hip mobility before, David, so this should be interesting. What do you reckon? And on the just short of a length balls as well, do you just go back for those or does it depend on the pitch?
Yeah, it's a 2-for-1 deal on this one. Okay, so let's cover the back foot one first because that's quite easy. It all depends on where the ball is. It all depends on the bounce of the pitch. So if the ball, it doesn't really matter where the ball pitches as such, but it does matter where the ball ends up when it's going past you. If it's reaching you above knee height, anything up to chest height, then you're probably best playing back to those kind of balls, because if you play forward to those, then you're likely to not be able to play them properly, especially when you get above hip height. But anything above knee height, you can play back to quite safely, and you can either drive or defend or cut or pull if it's short enough.
Yeah.
If the ball is staying below knee height, then you're probably better off playing forward, even if it's relatively short. Even if it's what you would say is back of a length, then if the ball isn't getting up above the knee, if it's a slow pitch, then you're risking things if you're playing back to that kind of delivery, so you're probably going to want to play forward to that. So that's that one.
Yeah.
Hip mobility. Now, that's quite interesting. So, yeah, it's definitely a good thing to have. Hip mobility is important because it reduces your risk of injury and it increases your performance in a whole range of different cricketing skills. Your throwing and bowling are two which are quite important. And it's also useful for batting as well. You can get a bigger stride in and that kind of thing. So it's definitely a very useful thing to have in terms of performance. And also, the more mobile your hips are, the less likely you are to get injuries in the hip itself and also in the knee and the ankle. So quite important area.
Is hip mobility generating power through the hips, David?
That's part of it. The bigger the range of motion you've got in your hips, the more power you can generate. That's just sort of a basic of physics. That's just, if you think to your levers, if you've ever done physics at school, when you talk about the different types of levers, then the longer the lever, the wider the range that the lever goes through, the more power you can generate at the end of it. That's why catapult works so well. So if you've got a very restricted hip, then you're not going to be able to generate as much power as if you've got a very mobile and flexible hip.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I'm going to give a little plug here for the Pitch Fishing Academy fitness course by Rob Arman. That does cover hip mobility in quite some detail, and covers exercises and things like that. So have a look at that if you want a complete answer, and also the whole thing, not just hip mobility, because you've got shoulder stability, shoulder mobility, lower back stability, knee stability. So there's lots of other areas of the body that you want to look at as well, not just hip mobility. So it's part of a bigger thing. But we're looking at hips now. So how do you improve it? Well, there's basically two ways. There's a third way as well, which I'll mention. But there's basically two ways. First is static stretching. And that's where you sit down, you lie down, you stand up, whatever, and you get your body into a position where you feel a stretch in the muscle, and you hold that stretch for a set amount of time. Usually that is anything between 20 seconds and a minute.
Yeah.
And that will increase the length of the of the range of motion of that particular over that particular joint. So in terms of hip mobility, you'd be looking at hip stretches for muscles around the hips, because you can't stretch the hips themselves, but you can stretch the muscles around the hips. So that would be your hamstrings, your gluteals, your big glute muscles, your small glute muscles, your IT band, your hamstrings, your quadriceps, your hip flexor muscles. So quite a few different things there that you can stretch out. And if you have a search around on the internet for static stretches that you can do those at the end of every training session, the end of every gym session, and at the end of every game if you really want to. And you can also do those stretches pretty much any time during the day. So, you know, if you've got a spare 5 minutes and you're watching a bit of telly or something, and you want to think, you know, what can I do while I'm watching telly? Well, you can do some stretches.
Yeah.
You can just do some static holds.
Yeah.
Carry on watching, you know, your favourite programme, Big Brother or whatever you like. And then and then also you can stretch. So that's quite good. The other thing is active stretching, which is more sort of mobility type work. So this is improving the range of motion of the around the joint by movements rather than by keeping still. So if you think about like swinging your leg forward and backwards, or swinging your leg from side to side, that's a classic hip mobility movement. And the idea is to gradually increase the distance of the swing of your leg. So if you're swinging it forward and it starts with your leg swinging up to about hip height, then each swing just try and get a little bit further up without going too far, because you don't want to overstretch it, but just try and get a little bit up with each swing until you're feeling the stretch there. You can also use a hurdle or a hurdle height obstacle, which you can step over it or you can duck under it, and that also helps. If you do that, say go under it, then step over it, then under it and over it, do that a few times, then that's getting your hips moving in all directions. And also exercises, simple exercises like body weight squats. If you can squat all the way down with your feet flat on the floor, then that is helping with your the mobility of your hips as well. And if you can't do that, then trying to do it will help improve the mobility around your hip area. So single leg squats, double leg squats, things like that all help with mobility. And that brings me on to the third point, the third thing, which is to strengthen up the core muscles as well, because you can't have mobile hips without having a strong core. And the reason why that is because if your core isn't strong enough to cope with you getting into a position like a full squat with body weight, then it's not going to let you. The nervous system's just going to kick in and go, "Oh, I can't do that. You're going to hurt yourself," and it will stop. It will literally stop you from getting any deeper into the squat. So you need to work on improving the strength of your muscles around the hip as well. So again, the gluteal muscles, the quadricep muscles, the stomach muscles, not only the ones you can see, but also the ones you can't see as well, you know, with things like planks and stuff like that, which we've talked about quite a lot before, so I won't go over that again.
Our next question is from Baz, and it's regarding the dreaded topic of captaincy. And he's just been made the captain of the school side, and he says, "A senior player in my side seems to believe that he has a God-given right to be captain. This player values only his own opinion and is unafraid to let it be known very publicly. And he makes it known when he thinks that I have made a bad decision. For example, this player will come up to me in the middle and tell me, not suggest to me and ask me, but tell me what I should do with my bowlers or field settings. If I decide to do anything differently, he will start to mouth off out loud about the fact that I don't have a clue about how to captain, despite my having turned out mostly very positive results. This may be down due to jealousy, as in junior cricket, this player was very much the star player for club and school. But in the past 4 or 5 years, my batting has improved to the point where I'm statistically a far better performer. I'm at a loss as to how to handle this player. And he begins to show dissent, and some other players have taken this lead as well. David, could this be a case of him being the more experienced player, being unhappy at the younger player being picked for captaincy. So he's deciding to show all his anger and disappointment to the new captain.
It's possible, but we don't know for sure. What it sounds like there, and it's interesting the way that he wrote it, is that it seems to me, to me anyway, I mean, I'm no psychoanalyst or anything, but it seems to me that we've got a, it's not a one-sided thing here. It seems to me like it's a bit of a battle of egos. Now, I'd like to get the other player's point of view to be sure about this, because obviously we're only getting one side of the story. We don't know exactly what's going on. But it seems to me that Barney, who wrote in, is saying in his email that this person is trying to outdo me, but I can outdo him because I'm a better batsman and, you know, I'm the captain. That's the sense I'm getting from that. So I don't think it's a one-way thing all the way. So it's a bit of a clash of egos. So how do we deal with a clash of egos? Well, the easiest way to do it is to take the ego out of it as much as possible. If these facts are correct, then he's in quite a strong position, because if his decisions are correct, which is what he's saying, his decisions are usually right. Yeah, tell me what I should do with my bowlers or field settings. If I decide to do anything differently, he'll start to mouth off. So what that says to me is that he's criticizing a mistake or just a change, just a decision? Because you can't criticize a decision if that decision works. If you put a fielder at slip and the bloke edges the ball to slip, then how can he possibly criticize that decision?
Yeah.
He can't. So I think he's probably in a position of strength here if we're reading it at face value. Nevertheless, we need to get the egos out of this. So it sounds like his manner is particularly abrasive. The style that he's decided to take with this is to undermine the captain. So take the ego out of it by taking time to talk to him and ask him for his suggestions before he comes up and tells you.
Yeah.
He can do that before the game, and he can do it very, very openly during the game as well. Wherever the bloke's standing, a new batsman comes in, set the field, then walk up to him and say, "Oi, Steve, what do you think of this bloke? Where do you think we should put our spare fielder? I've got a spare fielder here. Where do you think we should go? Do you think this is the right bowler?" Really, really plump him up. Make him feel like he's the big man and take his suggestions. He'll probably be quite surprised by that, because he's probably thinking, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's ignoring everything I say. But what you're doing there is showing that you've got the interests of the team ahead of your own battle of egos. Yeah. Then the next thing you can do is, as he's quite a good batsman, is you can make sure that you give him lots of responsibility while he's batting. So if whatever the situation is, rather than going up to him and saying, trying to give him advice, you know, as a lot of captains do, is, you know, just bat out for the draw, or just try and win it or something like that. Don't say anything to him at all. Just maybe say something general like, you know, you're my main batsman here. You know what you've got to do. And something like that, asking for someone's opinions and giving them a responsibility to do things themselves. They've got no comeback on you then if they get it wrong. Yeah. Because if they get it wrong, they're the one who's made the decision. Yeah, but if they get it right, you as captain get the praise for them getting it right, because you're the captain. So that may work. However, that may not work. He may still think that you are trying to manipulate him, or he may still there may be other things going on that we don't know about. He may still be quite vocal in his negative attitudes to you. Well, you can only go so far down that road before you have to take action. So you can either just completely, literally completely ignore it. When he comes up to you, just walk away from him. Don't listen to it. Just say, "Well, I'm making the decision here," and walk away from it. If, however, you keep making the wrong decision, you're the one in a bit of a problem there, because you're making the wrong decisions all the time, and he's chuntering away, saying, "Well, he's an idiot. He's getting all these field placings wrong. He's using all the wrong bowlers." But if you're getting it right, then he's got no way back.
Yeah.
However, if it gets to the point where you really even ignoring him doesn't work, because some people ignoring them and they just shut up because they're doing just doing it for the attention. But if ignoring him doesn't work, then you have to really take your real responsibility as captain as far as you can. And you're going to have to tell him that you're not going to stand up to his bullying anymore. And you can do that quite vocally as well. If he goes, oh, this guy doesn't know how to captain, you can go up and go, I'm sorry, I'm not going to put up with your bullying anymore. Go and feel down at Fine Leg. Can't hear you from Fine Leg. I notice it's a school team that he's playing for. He might not have responsibility for picking the team. But if you've got responsibility for picking the team, drop him and tell him why you've dropped him. You're dropped. You're a negative influence on this team. I don't care how good a batsman you are.
Yeah.
Or if you can't drop him...
That makes sense.
And he keeps chuntering away and he keeps moaning all the time, especially if you're batting second. Right, Steve, you're at number 11 this week. And you're at number 11 because you were undermining my captaincy. And I'm the captain and I get to decide the batting order. So you're at number 11. I don't care how good a batsman you are. Now... He might not have the power to be able to do that. Sometimes, especially school games, they can't do that. So that's the ultimate sort of get out, where you have to sort of flex your muscles. But you can use any or all of those techniques, and it depends on the personality of the player that you're using. They may or may not respond to that, and you're going to have to be quite clued in to the personality of that particular player to know what will be more effective. You're not trying to manipulate him. You're just trying to stop him from being a negative influence. And if you can't stop him from being a negative influence for whatever reason, then he's just going to have to be out of the team in some way or another. If you can't drop him, then, well, you can make sure that he's not involved in the game by fielding at Fine Leg and batting at 11. But that's a bit of a negative. I don't want to finish that on a negative.
Yeah.
The more positive approach is to say, you're my senior man here. I want you at my side. I want you to help me make these decisions. But you're not going to be captain. I'm still going to be captain. You're helping me make these decisions because you know what you're talking about. But do remember that I'm still the captain.
Our next question is from Steve in Australia. And he says that he's currently in his off-season. I'm 24 and last season I felt I wasn't as prepared as I should have been. Consequently, I had one of my worst ever seasons. I'm an opening bowler and bat 6-9. I'm determined to become superbly fit for the coming season. My areas to target include aerobic fitness, speed and power, both upper and lower body, and core stability. I have at least an hour a day to spare for my training. I would like to know your thoughts on which areas should I target first, and some sample exercises I can complete. David, hearing you talk about off-season training before, and I know there's an off-season, your guide to off-season training in pitchvision.com, but you've emphasized on doing strength and power exercises during the off season and then working on fitness as you come closer to the season, so in pre-season. But is it the right way to go, concentrating on strength and power in the off season?
That was quite a specific question. He wanted lots of detail there, and we can't really give that. If he does want that detail, then we do have, again, to give a little plug, the Pitch Vision Academy online strength and conditioning course. So have a look at that if you want detail. But it's the reason why I picked this question this week was because it's worth talking a little bit more about off-season training in terms of how you break up the season, because he had a big list of goals. I want to improve my aerobic fitness, I want to be stronger, I want to be more powerful, I want to leap tall buildings in a single bound, I want to be faster than the speeding bullet, whatever it is. He had a big list of goals there, and all of them are very highly specific to cricket, so very sensible of him to have those goals. But what you can't do, even in the off-season, is you can't ride two horses at once. You can't ride three or four or five horses at once. You have to pick your battles. You have to choose what particular element you're going to work on and work towards that. Now, that's called, when you do that and you do different elements at different times of the year, that's called periodization. And a very simple way to approach periodization is you start the off-season, once you've had a little bit of a rest at the end of the season, you start the off-season by working on general physical fitness, general preparation for the rest of the training. So that could be things like circuit training and aerobic training and things like that. highly unspecific stuff, basically. Then you move from that into more specific strength training. You're still not going completely specific, but just becomes a little bit closer, but it's still focusing on strength. So it's stuff like double leg exercises, like squats and deadlifts and things like that. So you go from general fitness, general preparation, circuit style training, to more slightly more specific strength style training. And then as you get into the pre-season, you change that then a little bit more specific again. You start to go more for speed and power type training. And then by the time you get into the beginning of the season, you should have just gradually, but like going towards the top of a mountain, you should have gradually gone up from base camp all the way up to the top of the mountain. So when you get to the top, you're at the peak of your fitness in time for the start of the cricket season, and then you switch to in-season training, which is a whole other subject. But there are areas where you can work on them all the time. We've talked about it before. Mobility and flexibility are areas that you can train all year round, and you probably should. And also core training in all its different ways. So you can, to a certain extent, you can periodize core training as well, but you probably would be doing some sort of core training all year round. So when you're planning your off season, if you plan it around those sort of three blocks of general work capacity, general fitness, then strength, then speed and power, then you're not going far wrong.
So it's really about changing it up, isn't it? So doing different things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can do it in any order, but that's just each one builds on the next one in that particular, if you do it in that particular order. You're just gradually getting more and more specific as you get closer to the season.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all our questions for today. Please subscribe to us on iTunes if you haven't already. And if you have an iPod, that's really useful. I do listen to it on the train, the way to work. And also, if you guys have any questions or any feedback, please email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. It's mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thank you for listening. This is Kevin Stappath from Sydney, Australia, signing off.
And this is David Hinchcliffe in the UK.